Well, President Trump just yesterday announced that the U.S. would begin the process of formally withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accords. For people who are concerned about climate change, that's not good news. And it's easy these days to become overwhelmed with the constant stream of bad news regarding climate change and our relationship to the planet that sustains us. We obsess about how or if our consumer choices can actually change anything, what kind of car we should drive, whether we should drive at all, should we stop traveling by air? What about plastic straws? It's easy to slip into despair, and some scientists claim that we've actually entered a new epoch in our planet's history called the Anthropocene, an epoch in which human actions dominate the natural processes of the planet, so humans have actually become part of geology. Which begs the question, regardless of what kind of car we drive, are humans destined to completely trash the planet? Our guest this morning says no. An ecologist who works for a number of First Nations on the central coast of British Columbia, Alejandro Freed, has firsthand experience that the marriage of contemporary science with the ancient practices of indigenous peoples can actually point a way out of this mess for us. It's all discussed in his new book, Changing Tides, An Ecologist's Journey to Make Peace with the Anthropocene. Alejandro Freed works as an ecologist with the Nuhulk, Kitasu, Heiltsuk, and Wikinaw First Nations in British Columbia. He's also an adjunct professor in the School of Environmental Studies at the University of Victoria. Good morning, Alejandro.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us today. And I hope my pronunciation of those First Nations that you work with is at least landed in the same province of being correct.
I give you a B-plus on pronunciation.
A B-plus. Well, there's room for improvement then. So how did you arrive at working with not one but four First Nations on the BC coast? What was your journey?
Yeah, so, these four nations are neighbors, and they have a long history after, colonization of having to react to external forces. Just taking in the shocks and, dodging things, external policies that are not compatible with their ways of being. So around 2007, they formally got together and said, as neighbors, we've had enough of this. Let's work together proactively so that we can create policies and work with a federal government move things forward in a way that's much more compatible with our views for conservation, for access to traditional foods. And they created the Central Coast Indigenous Resource Alliance, which is dedicated to marine use planning, to fishery management. And as part of that process, they wanted to integrate their traditional knowledge with the tools of modern science to be able to have a fuller dialogue with federal agencies for fishery management. And they created the position which I hold with them, which is that of ecologist and science coordinator. And that's I was just lucky enough to connect with that job opportunity, which I believe it's the best job I could have gotten. I feel very lucky to have that work.
So in the title of your book, you use the term Anthropocene, and it is being proposed by a lot of scientists as a new epoch that we are now living in. But it's still a bit of a controversial concept. Some people are saying, nah, we don't live in the Anthropocene, at least not yet. But what's your definition of that?
So in the context of the book, I was using the scientific definition in which you have a formal change of geologic epoch that it's measurable for changes in the stratigraphy of the Earth, the composition of the rocks, the biogeochemical cycles, like the phosphorus and nitrate cycles, changes to the atmosphere. Now, you're right that it's controversial in many ways because it's also the term has taken a life of its own, in which it has a lot of socio-political implications. And I think those other uses of the term have value as well, but scientists wanting to have very strict rules for how they define a change in the geology of the Earth, they want to be working separately from those other definitions with socio-political implications. And they've been working towards you know, the scientific one, in which you have the measurable changes in the stratigraphy. And one of many examples, there's a recent study in which they look at the fossils of trilobites. And these are, you know, these fossils are 500 million years old. And when you look at the chemical signature of what's become part of those fossils, about half of the chemical markers originated in corporate labs.
I found that to be an astounding example in your book. That really is really eye-opening to me.
Yeah, and it's really, in a way, it's so symbolic. I mean, here you have this 500 million year old fossils, and their chemical makeup is mostly of human origin. So that is the sort of notion that's behind the term Anthropocene in the use of my book. And so there's a working group of geologists that's in charge of formally defining the change from one geologic epoch to another. They haven't quite solidified on making it formal, but they're really close. If you look at their working papers, they're basically at the final stage of refining their definitions and their timing.
We're talking with Alejandro Freed, who is an ecologist with four First Nations in a central coast area of British Columbia, about his new book called Changing Tides, An Ecologist's Journey to Make Peace with the Anthropocene. Much, much more to talk about here on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll be back after a break. Back on today's edition of the Jefferson Exchange, I'm John Baxter, in today for Jeffrey Riley. We're talking about the Anthropocene, about indigenous wisdom and ecology with author Alejandro Freed. He's an ecologist for four First Nations in British Columbia. His new book's called Changing Tides. And just before the break, we were talking about just the concept of the Anthropocene. So is it safe to say, Alejandro, that you feel we are in the Anthropocene and we better well figure it out?
Yes, it is safe to say so, yes.
And so as you worked with the First Nations, was there an aha moment, a point that you can identify where this kind of all crystallized to you as a path for us to follow, as a way of going forward into the Anthropocene?
You know, it's been a journey with many aha moments. So let me just give you one particular example. Earlier in my time working with the communities, I was out with a 71-year-old elder called Charlie Mason. And we were out setting a ground line as part of the traditional fishery. So this is a ground line for halibut. And we're pulling up the ground line, and he doesn't have a hauler. We're in a really small boat. And he says, "Step to the side, young man. It's my turn to pull up the ground line." But I'm like, "Charlie, you know, I'm a little younger than you." He's 70-some years old. It's like, "No, step aside. I may be an important hereditary chief, but I'm not a king." And then we pull up the ground line, and, you know, we have about 30 halibut. And then he starts telling me how one of his uncles taught him to do an infusion of devil's club, which is, a very medicinal plant from the temperate rainforest, and how to soak the ground line in it. And the last time he did that, he, with 200 hooks, he had 120 halibut. And I'm like, "Charlie, how come we're not doing that?" And he said, "If we do that, we get a lot more than what we need." And that notion of taking only what you need, focusing on what you leave behind, is so inherent to these cultures. And it's through moments like that that I've come to realize that you had very large numbers of people from these cultures, you know, in the tens of thousands or more, living at high density, with very sophisticated fishing technologies and not depleting resources. So that is an example of an alternative, plausible story for what humans can be, in which you self-regulate how you use resources in a way that allows you to use them for thousands of years. And I think that is a foundation for how we can integrate the kind of knowledge that they have on how to do so, which is has a lot of ethical elements. It's not just about empiricism, but about behavioral norms. And integrating that with science, I believe, is what can give us a better path into the better range of the Anthropocene.
So early in the book, another example you use to illustrate the sophistication of the indigenous ecological knowledge is in a description you give of the rockfish populations of that part of British Columbia. Can you walk us through that, please?
Yes. I love rockfish. They're a fantastic group of species to work with. They're beautiful fish, but what's also fascinating about them is that you have some species that live a century or more. And for fish that live that long, they're really easy to overexploit because they don't mature, they don't become reproductive until they're in their, you know, late teens or 20s. They grow very slowly. So an industrial fisheries can remove a lot of fish before they even have a chance to reproduce. And also the older, larger females are much more fecund than the younger females. So if you remove the older, larger females, you really destabilize the population. Now, there are other species of rockfish that live a lot shorter lives. They only live about 40 to 50 years, and they can take over fishery exploitation better than the longer-lived species. So through archaeological studies, using ancient DNA from bones, fish bones in middens, archaeologists have figured out that the principal species that were being targeted where they did the study were the shorter-lived ones. And so what's also really key here is the shorter-lived species, which for those familiar with rockfish would include black rockfish, yellow-tailed rockfish. They tend to spend more of their time mid-water, while the longer-lived species like quillback rockfish, yellow-eye rockfish, they're at the bottom. So there's this separation in space between the two species groups. And so what the archaeological study suggests is that by targeting fish in mid-water, you're able to leave the more vulnerable, longer-lived species alone and focus on the ones that can take exploitation longer. Now, where that study was done, the record of rockfish fisheries goes back 2,500 years. And at the time of colonization, there was about 8,000 people living in that area. So to me, that's a profound statement of what humans can be. We can have this really dense populations, sophisticated fishing technologies, but use those technologies in a way that focuses on what we leave behind and taking only what we need. And I think this is a good example of that.
So with those two examples that you just gave us of your fishing trip with one of the First Nations elders and then the population of rockfish, that really comes into conflict with the process of industrial fishing. And so how have the First Nations that you work for dealt with industrial fisheries that are coming into their waters?
Yes. So one good example of how they've been responding to the overfishing of rockfish is by designing a network of marine protected areas where industrial and recreational fisheries would be excluded. Now, this is happening in partnership with the federal government, in which the First Nations are also a level of government. So it's an equal partnership. It's a change in governance. Now, this is still in process, so it's hard to tell exactly how it's going to pan out in the ground once it's all legislated. But it's definitely a sign that there can be this shift in perspective in which the indigenous knowledge is being used to select areas that are important for rockfish species that they want to protect from commercial and recreational fisheries.
Our guest this morning is Alejandro Fried. He is an ecologist, and when he mentions the federal government, he's talking about the Canadian federal government because he's an ecologist for four Canadian First Nations on the coasts of British Columbia. His new book is called Changing Tides, An Ecologist's Journey to Making Peace with the Anthropocene. You can join the conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange by calling us at 800-838-3760 by phone or by email. The email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I'm going to take a call from Anne in Eugene. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a lot of respect for First Nations people, but I don't see them as some sort of environmentalist movement, at least historically. Because before the people came over from Asia, there were horses here, there were camels, there were giant ground sloths, there were mammoths, and I don't know if you're familiar, and if you're not, you should look this up online, Paisley Clay Caves in Central Oregon, which has gone back to 14,500 years ago, and they find, you know, horse bones in those caves. All these animals became extinct after people came over from Asia. So how do you correlate that with your environmental stance? And it's not just here. You look at Hawaii, you look at New Zealand, you look at Australia, where we have records of what was there in archaeology before people got there, and what happened to those things. It's all mass extinctions. So I'd like to hear your response to that. Thank you.
Alejandro? Yeah, you have some excellent points there, and they're absolutely true. I mean, the scientific literature corroborates all these extinctions that were highly influenced by humans. But you know what I think is really key to keep in mind here is that when humans first arrived in the new continents, like the Americas, that was very early on before the cultures that developed took hold. So when they're first coming into the continents, they don't have the social institutions that were developed over time. They don't have the notion of living in place. They're moving and taking resources as they encounter them. And without being connected to place, yes, they led to extinctions. But once they started settling down, and in the archaeological record, that started happening in parts of British Columbia about 14,000 years ago. I mean, there's a village in the central coast that's that old, and that's where the descendants of some of the people the ancestors of some of the people I work with would go back to that 14,000-year-old village. Once they became settled and started living in place, that's where the stewardship practices, the social institutions require people to follow rules for sustainability developed. For example, this person, Charlie Mason, who I mentioned earlier on that I was out fishing with, he's a hereditary chief. And what his responsibility is to look after a particular part of the territory, keep an eye out on how resources are changing over time, and decided when people should or should not take resources from that territory. That tradition goes back for many, many centuries. So, yes, initially we were some form of roving bandits causing these extinctions. But once we settled down, we took responsibility for home and territory, and things began to change.
You know, I want to bring a different book into the conversation here, because I first encountered this whole idea and this whole concept, which is very eye-opening, in a book by Nancy Turner called The Earth's Blanket. And I believe she's also a Canadian author, and her book is more from an archaeological perspective. But one of the main points was that the First Nations were engaged in very intensive agriculture, but it's a very different kind of agriculture than Europeans.
Yeah, Nancy is a colleague, and she's done wonderful work. She's an ethnobotanist, and a lot of what she has documented is how there was a tending of the landscape. So it wasn't just going out and gathering resources from unmanipulated ecosystems. The people were changing ecosystems in gentle ways, like creating walls for that would allow the high tide to stay longer on a beach with clams, and boosting the productivity of clams, for example, or tending berry patches in a way that would increase their productivity, or roots in an estuary, and creating salmon traps that out of stone that would capture the salmon, but only for as long as people could, you know, were there to take what they needed, and then they would close the traps. So there are these landscape modifications, but very unlike industrial agriculture, they're landscape modifications that are promoting biodiversity. And that's very well documented in Nancy's work.
So one of the concepts that you bring out in your book, Alejandro, is the concept of the resilience of ecosystems versus kind of the old style view of conservation as, you know, the ecosystem is what it is and it's been this way forever and it'll be this way forever and we need to keep it this way. Can you walk us through that, the difference between those two views?
Yes, so I think it's useful to think of the metaphor of a bowl inside a cup. So think of the cup as the range of shocks that an ecosystem can take, and the bowl inside the cup as the state of the ecosystem. So let's say that a place gets logged, or there's a big period of warming, and that's shocking the ecosystem. And the bowl is just rolling inside the cup, and it's going up and down and up and down, taking these shocks. But the important part is that it's staying within the cup. It's never at the bottom where it's most stable, and that would be the old-fashioned view of conservation, that we're trying to keep the ecosystem stable. But it's bouncing around within the cup and staying within. That would be the notion of ecological resilience. Now, you can push that only so far. If a combination of, say, fishery removals, climate change, push that metaphorical bowl out of the cup, then the ecosystem changes entirely. And that's what we're trying to avoid in modern conservation, is shifting into this other state from which the ecosystem will not return. So in a simpler, tangible metaphor, that would be a forest that's been hit so hard by logging or fire or some combination of factors that it simply will not regenerate back, as opposed to one that's logged in a way that allows regeneration and the basic processes of the forest to restore over time.
So in your work with the First Nations on the central coast of BC, are you seeing ecosystems that have gotten so degraded that they are now in what you call that alternative stable state?
I'm worried. It has not happened yet in a complete way, but I'm worried that I'm close, that we're close, through the combination of ocean warming and fisheries. I worry that the decline in size, for example, of yellow-eyed rockfish might be leading towards an alternative stable state in which yellow-eyed rockfish simply cannot maintain their populations, and they're important predators. So once you lose an important predator, the food webs will destabilize. But now I'm just at the worrying state, and maybe instead of using the word worrying, I should use the word I'm at the alert state, that we have to ramp up the parts that we can control immediately, which is the protection of these populations through marine protected areas and through much more conservative fishery management. If we manage to do that, you know, to stop the removal of large old fish that have a very important role in population productivity, then we allow resilience towards the climate changes that are also, you know, difficult for these populations. We build resilience toward those climate changes by taking care of one stressor that we can't control, like fisheries.
And another example that you use in your book, and you go into a great deal of detail about this, is, you know, we're moving from rockfish to herring now. There was a, you describe a really interesting conflict with herring fisheries there in the book. And I want to get to that when we get back from the break. We have a lot more to talk about here. Our guest this morning is Alejandro Freed. He's an ecologist working for four different First Nations on the central coast of British Columbia and has a new book describing that and his worldview of Changing Tides. That's the title of it, An Ecologist's Journey to Make Peace with the Anthropocene. We'll have more with Alejandro as well as your phone calls and emails ahead on The Exchange after a break. Alejandro Freed, who is talking about his book, Changing Tides, An Ecologist's Journey to Make Peace with the Anthropocene. And Alejandro, just before the break, I brought up the issue of herring, because you spend an entire chapter in your book talking about herring fishery and the First Nations who seem to kind of run into the Canadian government and the industrial fishing industry. It's quite a story, because you have climate change, you have the blob. It's not a horror story. We know about the blob in Oregon. Indigenous knowledge and the amazing story of the herring themselves. So can you tell us that?
Yes. So herring are really emblematic of the main themes of the book. They're culturally extremely significant to First Nations. Ecologically, they're fundamental to the food chain. I mean, whales, seabirds, sea lions, fish, bigger fish feed on them. So when herring populations suffer, the whole socio-ecological system suffers. And then, of course, they're very important to industrial fisheries. So in British Columbia, herring populations got hit really hard during the mid-20th century, to the point of utter collapse. And so then there was a period in which they got a break from industrial fisheries, because the situation was so bad that they needed to be rebuilt. And things got back to a reasonable place in terms of their populations for a while. This allowed First Nations to continue with their traditional harvest, which is focused on taking the herring eggs rather than the adults. And this is one example of, you know, that traditional knowledge that's really fundamental to sustainability. In taking the herring eggs, you're removing a lot of individuals that potential individuals, but not very few of those are likely to survive to reproduce as adults. In contrast, a commercial fishery that removes large numbers of adults is taking individuals that have already made it that far into their life journey and are about to reproduce. So there's a huge contrast in the whole approach to the fishery. The other part that's really key from the indigenous traditional knowledge is that they say that herring are not one big monolithic stock in that would cover, say, the entire central coast of British Columbia. There's many substocks that spawn in individual spawning areas that behave very differently from each other. They spend their time in different parts of the ocean during the non-spawning season, and then therefore they're vulnerable to different things, and you need to manage the individual spawning areas individually. Now, both of these two points that they're bringing in, like the small spatial scales that's necessary to manage herring, and also the importance of not removing adults but being able to focus on removing the eggs, are thoroughly supported by all sorts of scientific research that's followed up in the lead. But there was a situation in which things had to get really bad again before they could start getting better. And what I'm referring here to is the federal government kept trying to open in areas for fishing that the First Nations were saying, no, you can't do that, and really threatening that traditional harvest. And then around 2014-15, there was some big instances of civil disobedience from the First Nations, in which they occupied the offices of DFO, which is the Federal Agency for Fishery Management, and refused to leave until there was a negotiation that led to the closure of the commercial fishery, and they were successful in doing that. And it was, like I say, it was one of these things that things had to get really bad before they got better, because since then, the commercial fisheries have not reopened in the Central Coast. We work with the federal government from a technical perspective in looking at the state of populations and in making decisions on fishery management. And we are starting to see in the last herring spawning season a little bit of rebuilding, in which we have bigger, older fish returning to spawning areas where before the bigger, older fish were absent because of the fisheries.
So did the First Nations say, this is our traditional knowledge, this is the way we think these fisheries should be managed, and the science supports us, and make that argument to the Canadian government?
Exactly.
And still it didn't work, so that led to the civil disobedience.
That's right. And after the civil disobedience, that's when dialogue became a lot more constructive. And the original argument of that the First Nations were making started to be listened to.
So in a sense, it seems like what you're talking about here is a new kind of regulation, because fisheries are regulated to a certain extent all up and down the coast, both in Canada and the United States. And there are fishing seasons. There are times when industrial fisheries are not allowed to fish, et cetera. And the same goes for recreational fisheries. But it seems like what we're talking about here is a kind of regulation, but that derives from tribal knowledge, from indigenous knowledge.
Yeah, that's where things are heading in Canada. I mean, it's a new form of co-governance that's being implemented into fisheries and marine conservation. I mentioned earlier the Marine Protected Area Network that's being developed, and that's very much co-led by First Nations, and much of what's being protected there are what are called cultural conservation priorities. And these are areas that are being deemed worthy of protection based entirely on indigenous knowledge and that do not necessarily have scientific surveys to go along with them. The indigenous knowledge is being trusted, finally, for its true value. Another good example is we had similar problems as with herring, with Dungeness crab. And after similar events, we were able to start working together with the federal government, and we have a working group of federal and First Nations scientists. And we've been able to change, legislate commercial fishery closures for Dungeness crabs based on the concerns brought by First Nations. And then one more of many other possible examples is the Fisheries Act, which is a federal act in Canada for managing fisheries, was recently amended so that it makes it mandatory for Indigenous knowledge to be incorporated into management decisions. Now, this is new, and I don't want to be too naive and expect too much of that. It was just implemented, revised in the summer. But it does open the possibilities for all sorts of meaningful co-governance to happen in the future. So let's just hope that it's a federal act that's going to have the teeth required to make real changes.
Alejandro Fried is our guest this morning. He's the author of a new book called Changing Tides, An Ecologist's Journey to Make Peace with the Anthropocene. You can join the conversation this morning on The Exchange by calling us at 800-838-3760, or you can send us an email. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Can you address the issue of cultural appropriation? Because you're not really suggesting in your book that the answer to all of our problems is for us all to try to become indigenous, because, of course, we're not, especially in North America, where, except for the native peoples, everyone is from somewhere else.
Yes, and that is a very important point, because cultural appropriation can certainly do a lot more harm than good and take legitimacy away from the sorts of arguments that I'm bringing forth. So in thinking about how to word what I think would be the constructive position regarding this, I read the works by Robin Wall Kimmerer, who's an indigenous plant ecologist, and who basically looks at plants as a metaphor for some really key questions that we are facing. And so she uses the metaphor of plants that are introduced from elsewhere and how they how they interact with the ecosystem once they're introduced. So there are many plants that basically take on a real invasive nature. They they outcompete the native species. They take all the water and leave none for the native species. And that's largely symbolic of how non-indigenous people have altered, this continent. But she also draws to the metaphor of plants that come and don't take much space and actually bring benefits to other native inhabitants by the way they might have medicinal properties that are beneficial for the people. And she uses the example of plantain, Plantago mayor, which is a European species. But it's become so well established in a gentle way in the Americas, a lot of people may think it's native, but she uses the term naturalized. And that was a bit of an aha moment for me in terms of being able to language these things. I come from, I descend from immigrants that, Jewish immigrants that, left the Middle East, several centuries ago, then were in Europe for, a few centuries, then just before the Holocaust, my family moved to Mexico City. I was born there. And then, I ended up in Canada. So I'm really the antithesis of indigenous. But that doesn't mean that people like me can't become really connected and inherent to place. And that's not through appropriating indigeneity, but rather by using the term, the notion of becoming naturalized to place. And when you become naturalized to place, you become mindful and respectful of the original laws of the place. And here I'm talking about the traditional governance systems, the traditional laws of the first peoples of this area, which are based on, good stewardship of the land and promoting biodiversity in ways that, both humans and non-humans benefit.
And there's an obvious example. If you immigrate to a different country, it's not like you can just abide by the laws of your old country. You have to abide by the laws of the new one.
Exactly. And here the metaphor is being extended to encompass more than one legal system. I mean, when I moved to Canada, it was pretty obvious that to live in this country, I had to abide by the laws that, Western society had developed for Canada. But what's not obvious, but should be obvious to the rest of us, is that there is more than one legal system, and there's another one that's much, much older than the one that Western society brought, and that's the traditional laws, which are of First Nations, which are captured in traditional stories, in oral histories. And, I would like to see that become inherent to basic education in the schools and and make it just as automatic as becoming knowledgeable and respectful of the Western legal system and having this other legal system be part of what we abide to.
We're almost out of time, and unfortunately, this is a big question I'm going to ask you, so I'm going to try and limit its scope. But you devote a chapter in your book to changing our culture's stories. Seeing the First Nations you're familiar with transmit a lot of ecological knowledge via stories, can you think of, like, the one story that we should really change about our society?
Well, the first story I would like to see change is the one that tells us that fossil fuels are essential for prosperity. That's a really old story that we need to just ditch. We have enough technological know-how, enough economic alternative models that can allow us to transition out of this fossil fuel dominant story. And I think if we implement the sorts of things I've been talking about ethical issues and how we relate to the rest of the planet, to our non-human relatives, I think we can mobilize society to shift, to ditch that old tired fossil fuel story and turn to a much better one.
We're going to have to leave it there. Alejandro Fried, thank you so much for joining us. Alejandro is the author of a new book called Changing Tides, An Ecologist's Journey to Make Peace with the Anthropocene. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And that wraps up today's Jefferson Exchange. We had production assistance today from Angela Decker of JPR News. Our student engineer is Randy Babbitt. If you're with us in the morning, the takeaway is next. In the evening, stay tuned for news from the BBC. I'm John Baxter. Join us again tomorrow for the Jefferson Exchange.